Mosca, Pepino, and I ran to the opposite side of the church where the ground wasn't paved and the hard dirt was perfect for playing marbles.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Philippe Dietrich. His novel, Playing for the Devil's Fire, published by Cinco Puntos Press, is a portrait of friendship, corruption, and playing for keeps in the small town of Isayuk, Mexico. A pueblo in a tiny valley only a few hours west of Mexico City.
Where the state of Mexico meets the states of Michoacán and Guerrero.
Let's learn about the characters El Chicana, Mosca, and Boli.
That's what they call me, Boli. It's short for Bolillo. Since my parents own a bakery, I guess it makes sense. I don't mind. It's better than my real name, Liberio, which is so old-fashioned.
Philippe Dietrich and our discussion of Playing for the Devil's Fire on Arts and Letters.
None of us had ever seen the Devil's Fire marble before. We thought it was a myth, one of those lies older kids tell to tease the younger ones. But Mosca was one of the best players in Isayuk, and he wasn't a liar. If he said he'd won a Devil's Fire, it had to be true. I wanted to see it.
From the studios of KUAR on Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with writer Philippe Dietrich, author of Playing for the Devil's Fire, a novel of innocence and corruption, mythology, and the pragmatics of violence, truth and honesty, lies and loss of faith.
I marked a straight line on the dirt with the heel of my shoe. Pepino tore a branch from a bush and started to draw a circle, but Mosca stopped him. Mosca's real name was Esteban Rodriguez. He was short and tough and fast and had big, round bug eyes like a fly.
I'm not playing for the Diablito Rojo, just so you know.
You chicken or what?
Pepino was older. He had bushy eyebrows and small eyes and a big, fat nose like a potato.
No chingues. I'll play, but I'm holding on to the Diablito for a while.
I couldn't blame Mosca. I'd hold on to it too. Maybe forever.
When you won a marble like that, you had to hold on to it for a bit. Let the news spread. How else were you going to build a reputation?
Philippe Dietrich, writer and photographer, former photojournalist. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Brad.
So, Philippe, just underneath the Devil's Fire, there's a kind of seeming innocence, but there's also malignancy, a disturbing backdrop that while making one's way through it becomes increasingly more sinister. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, isn't that how it always begins? One event followed by another, maybe one worse than the next. It's traditional or classic storytelling, and you want the rising tension, but it's also true in real life. It's not so much the events that happen slowly, it's that it takes us a while to understand what is happening and to see it. Usually we see it in retrospect and we understand it, but while it's happening, it seems invisible or slow and keeps underneath the surface.
And so you have a kind of childhood game, right? They're playing marbles, but underneath it in the town, there's some horrible violence that's occurring. Why did you set it up that way?
It is as much a portrait of Boli's life and what happens to him as it is a portrait of the town and what happens when evil comes to town. This is happening all over Mexico, and I wanted to portray that violence, that slow transition from a plain, small, innocent town to what it falls into by the end of the novel.
This evil is pretty sinister and pervasive.
It is, and it's based on the reality that Mexico is living at the moment and has been living for the last two decades, I believe.
Kind of an underpinning of fear and corruption. But also there is a lot of hope for the townspeople. You know, 99% of them are good.
That's right, and it's not their fault that this is happening. I think they are given choices, and we see some of them having to make their choices on whether to join the bad guys, pay off the bad guys, leave, or fight back. And this is a story of how they manage that.
And you begin the book basically with a severed head, a professor whose head is found in the plaza. Why did you begin with such a violent act?
Because I read about this every day in the news in Mexico. Every day there's a body found, or multiple bodies found, mutilated bodies, bodies with messages on them. It's beyond the murder. It's humiliating. It destroys the body. It destroys integrity. And also in rural Mexico, the teachers in many aspects are the activists, the ones that have the education and the desire to raise the voice to say something. And later we find out that this teacher was someone who lectured the children on ethics and patriotism and ideas, which is probably the reason why he was killed.
Right, and the line, I think, was he talked too much.
Correct. The message, a piece of paper with a message stuffed in his mouth, said that.
Okay, let's listen to that scene.
It was a hot Sunday morning when they discovered the severed head of Enrique Quintanilla propped on the ledge of one of the cement planters in the plaza. We ran to the front of the church. The men were making the way across the street to the plaza. The street vendors had abandoned their carts at the center of the square and gathered around one of the planters that divided the plaza into the shape of a cross. Nothing ever happened here until now. This is one of those moments everybody would talk about for months, maybe years.
So you worked for a half decade in Mexico as a photojournalist, traveling through the country and witnessing the terrible tragedies of the drug wars. You say that you wanted to put a face to the 80,000 plus deaths in the so-called war on drugs and to address the corruption and senseless narco violence that is tearing the country apart.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been going on in Mexico for a long time, even before the drug wars. I was there before Felipe Calderón came in and really started attacking the narcos, and this thing really escalating to the point that it continues today. But you would go out to rural areas and you would see military there, and you would hear about the abuses of the military. So it really, you never knew who the good guys were, what side the townspeople were on. I worked on stories of the army abusing the peasants on the pretext of looking for drug traffickers. But later, at the height of the drug war, I covered Mexico for an online publication, and the stories were heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. They still are.
It must have been a bit of a balancing act to try and portray your deep nostalgia for Mexico with also some of the stereotypes as well as some of the reality. How did you do that?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Mexico, and it's the country that I identify with as my home in many ways. And I miss it every day. And I miss the old Mexico, the one that I grew up in, the one that Boli grows up in before the drug traffickers move into town. I grew up in the outskirts of the city in the 70s, and we were free to roam about the country. We just wandered all over town on our bikes and hitchhiking, and I've never met kinder, nicer people than in rural Mexico at times. And this is, it's a horrible thing that it's happening, and I wanted to contrast those two things, as well as the corruption, the impunity that goes on, which is why this continues to happen.
And how did you work with, and particularly against, some of the stereotypes that when, you know, kids are reading this, you're trying to portray a message of hope and coming together of a community against the evil of corruption and violence and fear?
Yeah, I really attached myself to the idea that I was going to write a story. I wasn't thinking necessarily that I was going to write a story for young people. My protagonist is 12 going on 13, and I really attach myself more to the way I grew up in Mexico, to the conversations that we had, playing marbles, shooting off fireworks, wandering around the town. And one of the things that I wanted to do, contrary to what much of the literature or the writing about drug trafficking or about narcos or sicarios, is that I didn't want to give them any credit. I don't mention them by name. I don't talk about drugs. The bad guys are never identified as such. I didn't want to give them any credit for what they're doing. I wanted to focus on the victims and the people that have to live around this. At recess, I met Mosca in the schoolyard by the swings. He was surrounded by a group of boys who wanted to see the devil's fire. Word had spread about the Diablito Rojo. For now, Mosca was the king of the marble world. Mosca held up a fist, then he turned it and slowly opened his hand. There, in the center of his palm, was the little red sphere, El Diablito Rojo.
It was bright red and iridescent with a soft swirl of yellow at the center. It was beautiful. It didn't even look like a red marble. It glowed like a jewel, like fire.
I love this. It's a beautiful metaphor. Why the devil's fire?
Well, the devil's fire, it becomes a theme in the story. It brings me back to where I grew up. There used to be a highway near our house on the way to Toluca, and there was a big curve just past our neighborhood, and we called it the Devil's Curve. And a lot of things in Mexico seem to be were called that way. I mean, this curve struck fear in us. It's like, oh my God, the Devil's Curve. Not because the devil lived there, but because it was dangerous. So I kind of followed that theme throughout. Devil's Curve, Devil's Ravine. I think it's something very Mexican. I have an old Mexican mask in the mantle of my home, and it's a devil mask from Guerrero. And I love it, and my wife doesn't like it. It becomes a metaphor for many things in the story, and I think so in Mexico. It's dashed hopes and crime, the evil narcos, the marble. But I think it also means hope because of what happens at the end of the story.
I like the notion of being king of the marble world because their world is a microcosm of all the stuff that's swirling around them.
And one of the things that happens is they want to be the king of the marble world, and the narcos are trying to be kings of the Mexican world, or at least of that town. One thing was for sure, no one in the history of Isayoc had ever played marbles for 300 pesos, even Mosca. Even if Mosca lost the devil's fire, his reputation would still be solid. We marched together to the football field in the flats outside town. That was the place where all the important games, fights, and duels took place.
The field was mostly dirt with patches of dry grass and weeds and no trees.
On the other side of the dump, past the highway, the hills grew again where the Montes de Oca neighborhood looked like a giant construction site with dozens of concrete block and brick houses that never looked finished.
Unpainted with long stalks of rebar, sticking out of the roofs and walls, the ends covered with glass soda bottles.
The houses had been built along the narrow dirt roads one after the other.
All around, little colonias sprouting up like gray encampments.
Closer to the dump, clusters of small shacks of wood and tar paper spread out all the way to the edge of the highway.
You know, we talked about how you kind of sweated blood with some of these wonderful descriptive passages.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think it's the photographer in me. When I write, I see what I write. I'm visualizing everything. And this is born out of a lot of the towns and a lot of the places that I visited in Mexico. Also, playing for the devil's fires from the point of view of this, you know, 12, 13-year-old boy, and his descriptions have to be realistic to his age. And that was also part of the task. The voice and the tone needed to be maintained, and it wasn't easy.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Philippe Diederich talk about his book, Playing for the Devil's Fire. We'll be back in a moment. Let's return to our conversation with Philippe Diederich about his novel, Playing for the Devil's Fire. Just to step back, they're playing for pretty high-stakes money for kids here. No one's ever played for 300 pesos for a marble.
So Mosca doesn't want to lose the devil's fire. And he doesn't want to play for it. But what he does, he convinces Pepino, who's a little bit older, a couple years older than these guys, and has come back because he's interested in winning this marble. He wants that power. He wants to be the king of the marble world. So Mosca convinces him to make a bet. It's the devil's fire for 300 pesos, and each of Pepino's friends each pitches in 100 pesos. So the three of them, 100 pesos each. So that for the total of 300 pesos, they play a game, and it's Mosca against the three of them. It also becomes a bit of a metaphor for the loss of innocence. You know, they're beginning to move away from this innocent game of marbles to high stakes, which mimics a little bit of what's happening in the town when the narcos move in. Pepino explained that the game would be played but between him and Mosca, and Kiko and Chato, because they had each put in 100 pesos.
What about Boli?
No, just us.
Mosca wanted me to play for strategy. When we played together, we used our marbles to block our opponents or to set each other up for a shot. I suppose you could call it cheating, but that's just how it worked. Everyone did it.
And with Mosca, he has this devil's fire and he wants to hold on to it here. And in a sense, it's kind of an odd contradiction or paradox, right? Because there's hope that he maybe holds on to this during the game against folks who are trying to take it away from him, you know, for money, because he wouldn't certainly have played this game had it not been for so much money. But at the same time, perhaps the devil's fire might get a hold of him.
It can work both ways, is that the devil's fire is his hope. It gives him, Mosca becomes somebody because he's got the devil's fire. We see some of the other players, some of the young men in the story, turn and take the side of the narcos. And they become somebody by joining the forces of evil, if you will. And Mosca's kind of on the fence for most of the story.
And you say it in this town, so much is about reputation. Can the reputation also be for good?
The idea in these towns is when you think that generations after generations have lived there and everybody knows everybody and their family history. So you're stuck with what you have, with what you're born into in a sense. Boli is poor and he lives in a different neighborhood outside the town. His father has gone to the United States to work. It plays to the idea that they could be good or they could be bad, but everybody needs to survive somehow. And at one point we do see Mosca make certain choices that Boli doesn't want him to make, but he has to survive.
Let's continue to listen to the game a little bit.
Make the line here. Chato, draw a circle there.
Boli holds the cash in the diablito rojo.
Mosca pulled out an opaque white, orange, and blue Oli marble from his pocket.
What's this? You're not playing with the diablito?
Voy a jugar con mi mejor perico.
Let's see the devil's fired in.
Mosca dug the legendary marble out of his pocket and held it out for everyone to see. The little red ball shining between his thumb and index finger like an ember, a swish of yellow at its center.
The crowd of boys shuffled and murmured like they'd seen the eye of God.
Mosca handed me the marble. I put it in my pocket with the money. The four of us were gathered where Kiko had drawn the line on the dirt. We played rock, paper, scissors to see who would go first. Pepino won. I had never seen Pepino play before. He used a bluish cat's eye marble and put a lot of weight on his hand and pressed against the ground. His hand shook. After four turns, Chato left himself exposed. Mosca knocked his marble way out of the circle. Pepino was flustered. His face was getting redder by the minute. Mosca shot and missed Pepino's marble. His perico ended up too close to the line in the circle. It was Kiko's turn. He knelt and aimed his marble.
Focus, this is our chance.
Between the gusts, we could hear music coming from somewhere far up in the colonia. Kiko closed an eye, held the marble tight against the knuckle of his thumb.
Then his clear green agüita shot across the circle toward Mosca's perico. It nicked it, but didn't go far enough.
If he knocks mine out, I'll kill you.
And I like that line because you believe he might.
Well, and it kind of happens later in the book. It's kind of a little foreshadow for what ends up happening after everybody starts making their choices and either joining or walking away from the bad guys.
And this town is translated into a town of tears. Why so?
In Mexico, just like with the use of the word devil or mentioning devil, there's actually a famous neighborhood or area in Mexico City called Barranca del Muerto, Dead Man's Ravine. And so it continues with those metaphors. So I did some research to find in Nahuatl, the language of the Mexicas or Aztecs, and Isayok would be a word, the place of tears. And at one point in the story, we talk about how that came to be, the mystical story of the jaguars fighting or the gods fighting for the love of a princess who then is left alone and cries. And the rivers are formed that run along the ravines, at the bottom of the ravines.
You do work with some mythology here.
Well, that comes from reading some of the research, especially with the Mayans and the mythology that surrounds the names of towns and beliefs. And I wanted to add that for the depth of the place. The book touches on the mythology of the naming of the town and how this came to be. It shows you how old the town or the area is. I think in Mexico, people are really attached to their history. The same thing happens later when there's a conversation about how they melted the bells of the church in order to make bullets to fight during the time of the revolution. And it was a town that was never taken over by revolutionaries or by the federal troops. So they're fiercely independent people. They've been isolated in this little valley. Granted, the story of melting the bells actually comes from an old movie I saw many years ago. But the idea is that this history is spread throughout the town. It has deep roots.
Mosca's Perico was now in a direct line with Pepino's blue agüita. Mosca knelt and shot quickly. Almost without aiming, he missed Pepino's marble. When Mosca raised his eyes, I could tell he had done it on purpose. He was that confident. He wanted to beat Kiko first so he could face Pepino alone. Pepino studied the position of the marbles. It wasn't an easy shot, but it wasn't impossible.
When he aimed, his hand shook like an electric current was zooming across his body. He pressed down his hand, his face red, his body shaking like an old man. He missed.
Now, it was Mosca's turn again. He smiled at me. He knelt and shot quickly. His marble spun and knocked Kiko's green agüita out of the circle by about an inch.
It's still in.
Huh, it's out.
Pepino looked stunned. It was Mosca's turn. He had a decent shot at Pepino's marble, but it would need to be real powerful to knock Pepino's cat's eye out of the circle. Mosca knelt and considered the shot. He leaned to the left and to the right. He bit his tongue, held his breath, and shot. The marble flew like a bullet and smacked Pepino's with a loud clack.
The cat's eye flew out of the circle by at least a foot.
Rematch!
We're done.
A gust of wind blew over the field, bringing a wall of dust. When we reached the road and no one had jumped us, Mosca put his arm around my shoulder and laughed.
We rule this town, Bully. You and I, we're the kings of Isayok. We're the kings of Isayok.
So in reality, although they are the kings for a brief second, at least in their own minds, who does rule this town?
For years, it felt as if the people rule the town. There's something called usos y costumbres in these small towns where they follow certain rules based on what the ancients have always done or the elders have always done. But even with the corrupt cop, Pineda, they knew they were okay because it was their policeman. You know, they're the ones, the town chose that policeman. They managed him. So now things were changing. Who rules the town? It's not Bolian, it's not Mosca, that's for sure. It's not the policeman either, because we see that he's in the pocket of the narcos. So when Mosca beats Pepino at the game of marbles, he feels on top of the world, powerful. But now the newcomers, the narcos, are beginning to come in and take over. Things are changing. So the violence and the narcos are taking over. And that's the core of the novel, how change comes to a place when it's invaded by others.
So throughout The Devil's Fire, Boley is quite the moralist. He believes solidly in right and wrong and the forces of good and evil. And he desperately tries time and time again to do the right thing.
Right. It's his journey. He was brought up well, believing in good. But I believe the world is gray and not black and white. What is good for one person might not be good for another. A bad person might not always be that bad. Anyway, Boley also watches the wrestling movies. And at 13, he's becoming untethered to trust and fantasy. So he's starting to grow up. He's facing this reality. And there are bad people out there, but sometimes those who are good might fall prey to bad influence, greed, or just make a mistake. Mosca is an example of that. He's a survivalist, and in a way, more mature than Boley. His father's away in Kansas, and he's pretty much growing up on his own. So another one is also Boley's father, who Boley discovers was not quite everything he believed him to be.
And Boley is suffering a terrible burden, too. His parents are missing. They've left. And this is after the first body turns up of the professor, the second of a girl in the town. But I know a secret. There's a story to tell. It hides in the silence. Don't ask me to bite. And if you get too close, it might tell. And then the parents leave, basically, to try and tell the authorities what's going on, and they disappear.
They know that the local police is corrupt. The chief of police is not somebody that they can trust or that they can believe will bring justice. So they go to the city of Toluca, which is about an hour and a half away from Isayoc, to try to seek help from the federal police, and they never return.
And Boley and his sister go to the police chief, and that's not very satisfying either.
Right. When their parents fail to return phone calls or they can't get a hold of them, they haven't appeared, they make phone calls to friends and they can't find any information on them. They've basically completely disappeared without a trace. The only option that they have is to go to the local police station. And Boley's sister is a teenager. She's 16. And they go into the office of the chief of police, only to discover that he's there with these new people that have arrived in town who have quite a bit of an attitude and also demonstrate that they are pretty much in control of the chief of police.
There's also the role of the church in the town and in Boley's life. They don't rule the town either.
Perhaps at one time, Mexico is very Catholic, and the Catholic Church has a tremendous role in shaping the country. From the time of the Spaniards, when the Spaniards came to the New World, the church has been mistreating and converting the natives. And Boley's parents are devoted Catholics, as many Mexicans are. And Boley sees the priest as an ally. But the church, the oligarchy of the church in Mexico, is also in bed with the powers that be. So the novel is all about power, as we have been discussing. Boley slowly becomes suspect of the priest, and rightly so. But faith isn't what he comes to doubt. There are conversations where this becomes clear. He believes in what the church teaches, and in God, and in the Virgen de Guadalupe, but not in the church structure.
Dear Father, we pray and we ask that you bring us the grace and the mercy so that we may find Boley's parents. We must place our faith in our Lord, and we must pray to him.
Nosotros vamos a poner nuestra fe en Dios para encontrar a tus papás.
10 years down the road, I'll be cleaning out my closet, getting rid of old clothes. And I'll reach behind my and I'll stumble upon shoeboxes filled with old ghosts.
My parents had disappeared. Every day that passed, it felt as if their memory faded a little more. Hope was dying, and no one was doing anything about it.
Why do I hang on to your picture? 'Cause it kills me to see you, but it kills me not to.
The bench of the confessional creaked when I sat. I hated the little dark room. It was like a coffin, and it smelled weird, kind of like mothballs in my grandmother's closet. I didn't want Father Gregorio staring at me, smiling his pity smile.
Kills me to remember, and it kills me to forget.
I cross myself. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
Está bien. You don't have to worry, okay? No tienes. You don't have to confess. I only wanted to speak to you in private.
Is it about my parents?
Fortunadamente, no he encontrado muy poquito de ellos. I discovered that they never made it. Nunca llegaron. They never made it to Tuliacan in the first place. So, Boli, whatever happened, cualquier cosa que pasó, it happened between here and there. De aquí allá.
It kills me to remember, oh, and it kills me to forget. Oh.
Does Pineda know this?
Captain Pineda, Boli, told me that he has not been able to find any leads, but I have made my own inquiries.
Yes, that's what I've been saying. You think they're still alive?
Ay, 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 Liberio. No sé qué creer hasta este punto. No sé. We have to be very careful about how we proceed.
As I mentioned, I don't talk about the narcos. I don't use that word. Early in the novel, you learn that the governor built a highway that goes close to this town, all the way to Mexico City. So this is what brought the narcos into town. It's a new route. But in the book, no one ever calls them narcos. After NAFTA took effect and Mexico opened up to the U.S. markets and vice versa, it hurt a lot of peasant farmers. The new people are like an invasion force, the narcos. In all my writing, I'm very concerned about how political decisions by politicians and people outside affect the individuals that are on the inside. So here, the highway has changed the dynamics and has changed everything for the people living in Seville. And it has brought new people, the narcos.
This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with Philippe Diederich about his book, Playing for the Devil's Fire. To hear part two, go to artsandlettersradio.org.